Sustain 267.
Welcome to the Sustain 267 podcast, where we host conversations with Africans on climate change, the environment, and sustainability in Botswana and the rest of Africa. I am your host, Patokile Sitse. In this episode of the Sustain 267 podcast, we are in Bonn, Germany at the 58th SB Sessions. A bit on SB 58. This was the 58th intersessional conference that hosts the two main subsidiary bodies, namely the Subsidiary Body for Implementation and the Subsidiary Body for Scientific and Technological Advice of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, or UNFCCC. The SB sessions, which happen annually in June, guide and support parties, or rather countries in everyday language, in completing the technical work mandated for the June sessions that help deliver outcomes at the Conference of Parties, COP, which takes place towards the end of the year annually. This year, COP28 will be in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates from the 30th November to the 12th December 2023. Speaking of COP, today's guest is from Egypt, where the last COP, COP27, was held. Joined by Haneen Shaheen, we had a chat at the tail end of SB 58 and touched on Egypt post-COP27, her journey within the climate justice movement as a gender and climate activist, and ended with tips for civil society in the UAE on how to engage and work with their government as we count down to COP28. Haneen Shaheen is a board member of the Climate Action Network Arab World and volunteers as the head of entrepreneurship unit in Alashnek Yabaladi Association for Sustainable Development, where she supports youth to have their own green projects and increase environmental literacy among university students. Haneen holds a master's degree in gender and development with more than 10 years of experience in the respective areas and currently works as the Climate Justice and Gender Program Manager at UKAID in Cairo. And this is how our conversation went.
My beginning, I was a journalist actually doing a development investigative journalism pieces in Egypt. And we had a big revolution, 2011, in the Arab Spring Wave. And afterwards, it was very hard to any journalist to like practice journalism in a very free space. But my passion to the environment was like still there. And I'm like, I'm a gender-oriented feminist girl who is like pushing more for the gender files. And I found that when I was in that transition between journalism and development, that the climate space in Egypt, or like the environment space in Egypt, is a very big, wide, empty space, because environment was never on the list of the government priorities. And people were like saying, we are having a political economic situation, and it's very important for us to like focus more on what really matters, which is like environment matters. And then I said, oh yeah, I can work in that. It's like, we need more people. And let's go. So I started with the grassroots people, because I found that the most vulnerable communities are the most people who are hit by the environmental challenges that we are facing. So I started with farmers and people who have no access to fresh water in Egypt, south and north. And yeah, it started because of all my, like, I've worked on three levels, like education. First, to understand how they understand their environment, take their vocabulary and make them like understand what the bigger world is how they are talking about environment, and like translate what is happening in the outside world to them and vice versa. And also, so getting their voices, educating them about what's happening outside and giving them the support they need to adapt and survive in the changes that they are facing. So mainly this is what I was working. And it started from there. We were back then, 2012, 2013, we were like five people working in that field in Egypt. But thank God it grew properly.
What I'm realizing with a lot of people who end up working in the space or engaged in the space, it's either one, they've experienced it like their frontline community and it's a thing of I'm fighting for my life, or the people who end up working in the space, that it's a thing of the more I knew, the more I was just like, oh my goodness, I can't continue to live as I've been living. And then I smiled as you were talking about how in Egypt, it's a thing of climate change versus real problems and yep. real development. We see that across the entire African continent. So, you know, Africa is not a country, but we see it across Africa. And then you also talked about gender, that gender was quite prominent in the work that you did before you then transitioned to climate change.
Yeah, so the feminist movement in Egypt is very like big and strong there, because, and it was like joined to with the 2011 revolution. So like it's very old, the feminist community. We've been talking and working on women's rights and supporting the actions to a better quality life, better laws, better presence of women in different fields. And the only challenge that I found is that there was no linkage between what the climate vulnerability is with the women vulnerability in different communities, especially farmers community and rural communities in general. And it was very important for me to introduce that concept to the feminist movement in Egypt. And I think I did a good job, because currently, we do have like particular NGOs who are working on women problems, gender issues, that actually addressing them from an environmental perspective and making sure that they are understanding the context. The challenge that we faced, that still, do you know, like the economic political situation is like putting the climate and environmental situation back in the list, like down the list. So when I go to the women, when I started working with the women in groups, telling them about the environment, it was, yeah, but you know, we need to change the person's law first. We need to make women inside this arena first and then like educate the women back home or the grassroots on their environmental rights. But eventually it's like, yeah, we can do everything together, because you cannot bring women to these spaces without educating them about what's actually happening in spaces and why it's important for them to be in the space where they speak about environment and they speak about qualities, stuff mm-hmm. like that. So it's like from where to start, but we made our, like, we started to push it and make it together when it comes, yeah, gender is very relevant to environment, and we cannot, like, break, the movements has to work together. So the ecofeminism now is like growing, and I hope it lasts, inshallah.
It definitely shall. And when you talk about policy, it's a thing of, yes, we need policy, but we also, everyone can do something at every level.
Yeah, definitely.
So last year, your country, Egypt, hosted the African COP. Congratulations. I mean, it wasn't perfect. Nothing ever is, but they pulled it off. I had the opportunity to attend it, and I mean, again, there were some snags, but they did it. There were, what was this? There were renewable energy buses on the roads, and it looked like the city was tailored to be environmentally sustainable. A lot of commitments were made. You laugh when I say that. Please.
The challenge is Sharm El-Sheikh is not Egypt, so we have to say that. And that was our, like, the civil society voices. Sharm El-Sheikh is not Egypt. And it's like, it's a resort city where you can easily tailor it to look like whatever you want. However, some initiatives that took place in Sharm El-Sheikh was tested in the capital, Cairo, which is the biggest, and it has like 30 million person living there and traveling, coming back and forth to it. So it's a big, big city. So some of the initiatives, like the bikes, the electric buses, the electric trains and stuff like that, they are introducing it and they are working on it to embed it in the Cairo system. But still, Cairo is it's one of the biggest cities in Africa, most polluted, lots of population. So we have a lot of problems. And it's honestly, we benefited from COP a lot, but the city, the main capital, didn't.
The people.
For the people, didn't benefit properly from COP as Sharm El-Sheikh, which is a resort that's not all the Egyptians. Actually, not most of the Egyptians go to.
So you did the African thing of when you've got the guests, you give them the good plates, not the everyday plates. Yes, you gave us Sharm and not Cairo.
Yeah. So honestly, that was a very big challenge because Sharm El-Sheikh is not affordable for Egyptians in the regular days. It's expensive. It's a resort. So if you want to show, if you want to make it an African cop, if you want to make it as inclusive as possible, if you wanted to introduce our agenda of like, give us the money. We want the climate justice. We are vulnerable. We are poor. And that's because of your greediness. Sharm El-Sheikh was not the right place to do that. Honestly, it's just like, it does not show all these points that that COP was planned to show. So that was a very big challenge. And the civil society need to like to communicate that with the international civil society for them to know that we don't live like this every day. We don't have bikes. We don't have electric taxis. We don't have that. We are struggling with the diesel cars back in the capital. We are struggling with motorbikes that is not insured and have a lot of pollution coming out of it. No good transportation system. So, and it's the same everywhere in Africa. And for us, it was, okay, thank you.
But so with that being said, then COP27 versus the reality, you hosted COP, a lot of commitments again were made, but how much of that still stands? What kind, from a civil society perspective, which of those changes sustained? What kind of positive changes have you seen? Have you seen any changes, not necessarily positive, but like, have you seen any changes in any direction since hosting COP?
Honestly, since announcing Egypt is going to host COP, lots of changes happened, especially the relationship between the government, the negotiators, and the civil society. There is none. There is no publicity for what is happening actually in the international field when it comes to climate change. Nobody knew anything. I've been working in this field for more than 10 years, and my mom never knew what is actually happening till last year. Because last year, the Egyptian TV, the newspaper, the public was talking about COP. What is COP? Why COP is important? Why Egypt is hosting COP? So it was for the first time the mass population is like educated about the International Environmental and Climate Change Convention, which was for us as civil society who are working on education basically is a big win. Finally, people can understand the language we are using. Lots of meetings and lots of relations built, honestly. Like, we've been introduced, and honestly, the government reached out to the civil society for the first time ever. We want to sit, we want to talk, we want to know what you are working on, we want you to participate. We had a very big challenge that we only had one NGO in Egypt that is accredited in the UNFCCC. We have like more than 4,000 environmental NGOs in Egypt operating and working, but none of them had accreditation to enter the convention. So it was a very big challenge of inclusion and participation. And because of the constant relationship with the government and the presidency of COP last year, we managed to get like mostly all the civil society working on the environment to COP by 1 year accreditation thing. And it was honestly a big win. Lots of people, they never knew what is happening here. And oh my God, we have an access. We can go and attend such a convention, such meetings.
Is that change sustaining? Are you still seeing it now? It's
so
8 months later. Six, eight months later. Those positive change.
The relationship definitely slowed down. No, we are the civil society. Actually,
the honeymoon is over.
Yeah, the relationship was built because we were like scattered across the government. We were scattered across Africa as well. Mm-hmm. Like during this COP, we built the Egyptian civil society, built really good relationship with the civil society in Africa, which was not there before, and built a really good relationship with each other inside Egypt. That one remained, and that one stayed in put. Like, we are still in each other's chains. We talk to each other. The government, no. It's like we barely see them. It's just like the same way that was before. The people who have the chance to come to such events can meet the government, but the people who cannot, خلاص. But what happens actually is now the government know who is working on what. And whenever there isn't a funding opportunity, whenever they want a civil society partner, whenever they want to implement something, they know where we are and how to find us. Mm-hmm. That was not the case before. So opportunities, funding opportunities, UN project, mega projects, the government has like a joint thing with the Green Finance, the Green Climate Fund, and they want a civil society member to be part of it. They have lots of options. Before, they only had one option and they just go with it. And that actually we are facing. Now we are having the national dialogue, where the national dialogue is something...
So national dialogue was said in quotes, in air quotes.
Mm-hmm. The national dialogue is something that we talk about all the aspects of the political, economical, civil situation in Egypt. And prior the elections, the presidency elections, which is going to happen next year. And we are invited to it for the first time ever. Because now we are on the map. That was not before. Yes, the relationship was not as close as during COP preparation, but we are on the map. At least now, when I met my delegation here, they said, you're coming with us to Dubai, right? Mm-hmm. Before, it was like, what are you
doing? Who are you?
Yeah, who are you and what are you doing here? They knew who I am, but it's like, what are you doing here? Why it's important for you to come? It's like the relationship changed. At least we become friends.
So from what I'm getting from that, the biggest win was the relationship, which is a big win in terms of an investment over time, because that's where all the work starts, relationships, the conversation, and then it builds a strong foundation. You're talking about a lot in terms of civil society, the role that you played, some of the things that you then saw. The COP28 will be in Dubai this year, and what appreciating that the landscape there is very different, but it's still a COP28. We're still talking, how do we address climate change as parties, as countries, as movements? What tips would you have for civil society there in terms of maximizing impact, or just from the experiences you've learned, well, from your experience at COP27 and also 6 months later, looking back?
My first advice is to build a network within, because this is actually what saved our during COP. Excuse my French. We faced a lot of challenges, from badges to accommodation to flights to support people coming from Africa who, when they arrived, we had like during COP27, we had a huge logistical dilemma for like the hotels and the flights and stuff like that. And without the network that we built within ourselves, between us, we couldn't help each other, and we couldn't have helped the people coming from different civil society from all over the world. Mm. Like people didn't got the chance to have like rooms, hotels, stuff like that. So build a network is very important. Educate each other, because that's what we did. And within this network, we have people who attended COPs several times, and we have people who never heard about COP before. We made sure that everybody who's going to be part of this event, or like have a chance to go to this event, know what is actually happening. Because it's always that... Because these events are very accessible to the international civil society more than the African and the Arab civil society. Mm. Because of funding, because of accreditation, because of lots of reasons, because of colonialism, a lot of things. But so it was very important for us that when you come to an event like this, to understand the tracks and what is actually happening behind the rooms, because it's very overwhelming and it's very exhausting and you cannot attend everything. So what we worked on is, I'm not just only telling you or educating you about COP. I'm telling you what's actually to follow in the COP. If you are interested in the negotiations, these are the tracks. These are the rooms. These are the groups. That's what you follow. If you are interested in side events, here is the side events and how you plan your day. If you're interested just to network, these are the places or the events or the meetings that you can go and network in and get out opportunities for your organization. So that helped the civil society a lot. Lots of people made really good relations. Lots of people actually designed projects and they are implementing it on national and regional level. Third thing, stick together. and build a safety backup plan, because you never know what's going to happen. Lots of actions happening, different people coming from different backgrounds. It's important to protect yourself, and it's important to know how to react if you are going to be part of an action. We are in a very critical region, and we don't have the freedom that like the global north does have. And that's our reality. But still, we are activists, and we wanted to see the change. And in order to see the change, you have to do actions. And to do actions, you have to protect yourself. And finally, it's important to know what your presidency is working on and to have a relationship with them. And I'm not saying to like be their best friend forever, but it's important to be friends. It's important to have that channel of communication. And honestly, and I have to admit that to the Egyptians, they were very, very good in that matter. Like, they started the channel. They were always there when you gave them a call. They always picked up. And they were never going to do that unless it was like, it was very important. It initiated from ourselves as a civil society, and we pushed to have that kind of relationship. So we were not best friends, but we were friends. We had the chance to talk. So these are the main, and stick with the good people, which are the observers and civil society from all over the world. We take care
of each other. Yes, ma'am. So get that preparation organized, know what you're looking for, consider safety, have a relationship with the presidency, because the needle will move a bit more and a bit faster if we're working together.
Sure.
So we're at SB58. Today is the last day. A few things haven't been decided yet. As the final question, you shake your head. How has this experience been for you? Thoughts on what has happened and outcomes so far? It's been 2 weeks, and I mean, we closed today and the agenda was only adopted yesterday. It's been quite a ride over the past 2 weeks. Your thoughts on SB58?
Last year, it was the same, or like 2 weeks, one day earlier or something. Mm-hmm. Like, the SBs for me is always like, oh my God, how? It's like I'm getting old and nothing is happening. Like, 2 weeks are wasted of my time. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I think this one was very real in terms of, it's going to reflect what COP is going to look like in terms of how they are challenging, how the groups and the countries are challenging each other on the agenda items and on the in the working groups, how it's going to be a really interesting fight on finance during COP and on the adjusted transition, for example. For me, it's going to be really interesting. Also, the agriculture was fantastic. It's like, oh my God, this is exactly the real bad politics that is like taking over. It's just like, oh my God, can't wait. So, I felt like, oh my God, this is how COP is going to look like.
Mm.
But I loved that by the end of these 2 weeks, the delegates felt the urgency of like, we need to get this done. It's like, we are not going to waste it. And that sense of urgency was not there before. Like, finally, they are getting it. We are losing time and you are not progressing as fast as the earth is boiling. So it's like, we need to run faster. I sense that. However, it's still a lot of like blocking and a lot of like wasting of energy and time. So I'm not optimistic to the upcoming period or COP28. But I'm not that pessimistic as well. Like, I'm not 2014 pessimistic. I am like in the good square. I'm worried, because I believe Dubai is going to be challenging on, like, our goals is like kick polluters out and fossil fuel. And Dubai is not going to look like that. Dubai is not going to support our messages in everything and all the its matters. So I'm a bit challenged by that. I'm a bit worried. However, lots of my colleagues think that there is no point to have a COP in a fossil fuel country. A producer, I believe otherwise. Yeah. I believe it's very important to go there, say out loud that we need this behavior to stop, and we need their willingness and all the people who are investing in this thread of production to stop that and change and trans and do the right transition in a very justice way. So, yeah.
Thanks for sharing that. So today's the last day. The texts that come out of here, if you look at the show notes, we'll add them there. And then because you said you're not optimistic, and we need to end on an optimistic note because there's a lot happening out there that is not as optimistic. And for me, action usually fires up my optimism on us addressing the climate crisis in a way that serves people. So in a call for action, what would you like to see governments do? What would you like to see civil society do? What would you like to see individuals do? First, let's start with government. Let's keep it to two sentences, governments.
I want them to listen to each other and listen to the vulnerable countries first and, like, stop blocking. Like, open your minds, guys. It's like, it can be done. Stop blocking, stop wasting time.
And then civil society?
Keep pushing. Keep us for space. We can get it if we are resilient enough. I know we are resilient. I know, but the problem is we get tired of, like, shouting and screaming and standing. It's horrible. I know, but we need to keep on pushing. And we need more people. We are getting old and tired. Like, the fatigue is horrible. So
yeah, and then individuals?
And the individuals, keep following. Ask questions. Like, lots of people are online, out there to answer the questions. Environment, climate change is not a boring topic. It's not a niche topic. It's not a white topic. It's an everyone topic. It's very important, everybody, for everyone to speak, like, environment and to speak climate change and understand what's happening. So we need to change that perspective. I know we are in our continent. It's a bit, we have a lot of challenges and we have a lot of problems, but the world is on fire already. Everybody's suffering with what we are suffering now. Yeah, we are more, but still, environment is the key, is the answer. It has lots of solutions, economic solutions, political solution, and the real equality that we are looking for. So, and that's what actually drove me to the environmental space. I felt that we are all gonna die the same way.
It's a bit morbid.
No matter where you are, no matter where you come from, what color you are, you are going to be doomed by the environment, by Mother Earth. So we have to protect it equally. So, yeah.
And on that optimistic note, because I asked, Haneen, thank you so much for talking to me.
No worries. It was a pleasure.
Oh, I enjoyed that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sustain 267 podcast. Find the links mentioned in our conversation in the episode notes. Don't forget to subscribe to the Sustain 267 podcast on whichever platform you are listening from so you get a notification every time our rather sporadic episodes are published, and also give us a rating so we reach more people and amplify the voices of Africans further. Finally, a huge thank you to the Sustain 267 patrons for the financial support that has made this episode possible. So if you appreciate the Sustain 267 podcast and have learned anything from it, feel it's necessary, and would like to contribute towards the production of future episodes, please become a patron from as little as $3 a month. The link is in the episode notes. I am the host of Sustain 267 podcast, Patokile Sitse, and the sound engineer is Maleho Mabgoti. Let's connect on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter on our handle at Sustain267 and continue the conversation. Take care.
Sustain 267.